The death of the Arkansas Gazette on October 18, 1991, is a story filled with far more than just local ramifications.
Today in Section B, in this two-part series on arts and letters, we'll be talking with journalist, researcher, and professor Donna Lampkin-Stevens. Her book, If It Ain't Broke, Break It, How Corporate Journalism Killed the Arkansas Gazette, published by the University of Arkansas Press, offers a firsthand account of how and why the Arkansas Gazette, then the oldest newspaper west of the Mississippi River, died after perhaps the country's last great newspaper war. We'll hear from Stevens, as well as reporters, editors, executives, and attorneys from both sides of the newspaper war.
The newspaper industry must recognize that much of its past is mirrored in the present and future. And even if its responses to previous challenges were wrong, the knowledge of those responses and ensuing results can help inform the tactics used in the battles of today and tomorrow.
If It Ain't Broke, Break It, with Donna Lampkin-Stevens on Arts and Letters. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities.
But choking and floating are nothing short of my worst misery.
Today we'll be exploring the final years of the Arkansas Gazette. We'll hear from former reporters and editors from the paper and its once rival, the Arkansas Democrat. Journalism professor and scholar Donna Lampkin-Stevens will be our guide.
Wounded by the fiercest newspaper war in the United States in the 1980s, J.N. High School's heirs sold the Gazette to the Gannett Corporation, the country's largest newspaper chain, in 1986. The inability of the Gazette's key players to cope with the challenges of Arkansas's newspaper war has lessons for today's tumultuous journalism climate that has only intensified since the Gazette died in 1991.
The story of the Arkansas Gazette is more relevant today than its tale of tragedy in 1991. Its story shows a typical transformation of an American newspaper from independent local ownership to corporate control that illustrates what happened to American newspapers in the generation following World War II. To take us into the newsroom and help us to understand what happened to the Arkansas Gazette, Donna Lampkin-Stevens, professor, producer, journalist, welcome.
Thank you, Brad. It's a pleasure to be here to talk about the Arkansas Gazette.
You have such passion for the Gazette. And how did you disentangle that or deal with that?
Well, I used my training as a reporter. I tried to be very fair and balanced. Although, obviously, I was on the losing side in Arkansas's newspaper war, I tried to write it as a reporter. And, you know, the passage of time had helped some. But I was told by my dissertation advisor, who used to work for the Democrat and the Gazette, that I was being too fair, that I needed to draw some conclusions. So I toughened it up and drew some conclusions. And then when it went to the University of Arkansas Press, I got a little feedback that said I was unfair. So I tried to go back and make it fairer. And I think I succeeded. I mean, it's hard when you are so passionate about something. But I think also that the passion is a positive thing because I think it comes through.
After Jay in high school's death, the Patterson family would be charged with continuing for a second generation its patriarch's ownership style.
That style had been marked since 1902, no matter what the cost, by a commitment to quality journalism and a progressive voice.
In 1974, the Hussmans, Walter E. Sr. and his son, Walter Jr., bought the Arkansas Democrat. By 1977, found that their paper could no longer compete with the Gazette and offered Gazette publisher Hugh Patterson a JOA, or a joint operating agreement, several times. What was Patterson's response?
You know, looking back now, Brad, it's incredible. But each time, Hugh Patterson said he was not interested. In most other cities with JOAs, the afternoon papers eventually lost their viability because, you know, by this time, women were working, you had the television news, and people just didn't want an afternoon paper anymore. And so it became a financial drain on the whole operation. And Hugh Patterson, as head of the family, head of the newspaper company, did not think that that was fiscally responsible.
My name is Ernie Dumas, and for some 31 years, I was a reporter and editorial writer for the Arkansas Gazette. He came to us one day and told us about that Walter Hussman had approached him and they had had lunch or had a meeting, and Walter had proposed a joint operating agreement for 10 years or something, and it was favorable to the Gazette and so forth. So he was very candid about it. He said, you know, I thought about it, but, you know, he said it's just not workable, and it would drain both newspapers. It would be harmful to us as well. So he just spurned it. It turns out it was the worst decision of his life. He should have accepted that.
And there was a telling conversation when Patterson apparently told Hussman that he would, quote, need to create a public monument to the fact that you've been a failure. Hussman told me that he wasn't sure what Mr. Patterson meant by that.
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't understand that at first. I kind of understood it a little better. I think there was actually some economic reasoning in it, which didn't come across at first. But the public monument to your failure, I thought, you know, do you go put up a statue or something? But no, what he meant was, you've got to prove you're a failure, and the only proof that you're a failure is that you can't even sell your business to anybody. He never said that, but I think that's what was going on in his mind.
He said, you know, if we're coming to you, we're saying we're going to sell the paper, we need a JOA, obviously I failed. He said, but I don't know if I go out and take out an ad that says we failed, then nobody's going to be able to come in and buy the paper. But I think it would be easy to believe that the young man was insulted by that.
How many times did they go to Patterson? It wasn't just once.
No, three times.
And he denied it all three times?
All three times.
I went to see Hugh Patterson and said, look, we tried the best we could and we haven't succeeded. And, you know, we're willing to do a joint operating agreement, let you run the operation, let you run all the business operations, set the prices, divide the territories, do whatever you want. All we want to do is just, you know, we'll publish the newspaper. They came back and said, you know, we're really not interested in that. Then we went back another time, and I thought, well, he's not interested. Gosh, he must not think it's in his financial best interest to do that. So basically, I came up with a deal where I said, what we'll do is we'll split the profits 50-50 on the first $600,000 of profits. Well, the Gazette was already making a couple of million dollars a year, you know. Then after that, you get 90%, we get 10%. And they said no to that. So I thought about that, and I went back later, and I said, okay, here's the deal. You get 100% of the profits up to what you made the previous year. And they said no to that.
In retrospect, that was probably a bad business mistake.
Bad, bad. In my book, I count down six mistakes that Hugh Patterson made, and that was one of them. Walter Hussman had nothing to lose. They were about to go under.
We'd never shut down a business. We'd been in the business since 1909. All the newspapers had been successful. Got in the radio business in 1933, before I was born. Successful in the radio business. Started the first television station in the Shreveport, Texarkana market. It was successful. Got in the cable TV business in 1964. This thing was, in the history of our company, pretty major failure.
So he said, if we fight, what do we have to lose? We're going to lose if we don't fight.
I needed somebody who, when they woke up every morning and they read the Gazette, if there was a story in the Gazette that we didn't have, he was going to be upset.
Enter John Robert Starr, the Democrats' executive editor.
John Robert Starr was another important factor in Arkansas's newspaper war. He gave the Democrats sort of a personality.
I'm Meredith Oakley, and for a number of years, I was a reporter, an editor, and columnist at the Arkansas Democrat. Bob Starr was one of a kind, thought on his feet quicker than anyone I have ever known, including Bill Clinton. He was very intelligent and very smart and very smart-mouthed and very type A. And I loved working for him because you could say anything to the guy. And even if he reamed you out, he had heard you. And he didn't hold a grudge.
Bob McCord was our editor, and he came down and he said, look, this idea you're talking about really being a lot more competitive with the Gazette and everything, I'm not the guy to do it. So I kind of tried to talk him into it because Bob McCord was a good editor. And he said, no, I don't want to do it. And I said, okay. And I said, well, I got to find somebody that wants to do it. And so he came down later and he said, I've got an idea on who might do it. And I said, who's that? And he said, Bob Starr. And I said, really? I said, I don't know. Bob Starr, you think so? And Bob Starr was interesting. I knew Bob pretty well because he's head of the AP. And he was kind of a garrulous guy, you know, big, kind of rotund a little bit, and always kind of laughing and smiling and everything. And I'd see him at like a Sigma Delta Chi meeting or something. I thought he'd been drinking. And so I told Bob, I said, gosh, I don't know about Starr. I think he might have a sort of a drinking problem. Bob said, oh, no, he does. He's a teetotaler. He doesn't drink anything. I said, he's just naturally like that. He said, oh, yeah, yeah, he's just naturally like that.
Most of the people who I would be comfortable saying who worked for him were scared of him. They didn't like him a lot, and they were intimidated by him. But I wasn't, because I learned early in the game that there was a lot of bluster to him. But he was a smart man, and he would give you a fair hearing. And he liked to debate, and he liked to argue. You know, and if you did that, he was happy. And most people were afraid to do that with him. He knew all, or so he thought. But he knew an awful lot about a lot of things, so, you know, I had a great deal of respect for him.
He had battled the Pattersons in the past, and he relished the opportunity to go up against them one-on-one.
It's hard not to see his face sitting on top of that newspaper stand with the knife in his teeth, a vest on, a helmet, saying,
I'm John Robert Starr, and I'm
declaring war.
And that ran in the Arkansas Times.
It's a bit ridiculous.
It is ridiculous, and apparently Walter Hussman had no idea John Robert Starr was going to pull this, and Hussman told me that he nearly fired him over it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was just totally uncalled for, you know. It really made me upset, and I thought, this is terrible. This is not, we're not trying to kill the Gazette. We're not declaring war. We're trying to compete with these people. We're trying to save our newspaper, you know. Anyway, when he did it, I got so upset about it. I used to go out and jog every day, and I was out jogging, and I thought, by the time I finish jogging, I got to decide whether I'm going to fire him or not. And normally you would have fired the guy, but I thought, my gosh, this guy looks like the perfect person for the job. Maybe he's not as perfect as I thought he'd go up and do something like this, but he's competitive. He's a good newsman. He's from Arkansas. Who am I going to get if I don't have him? So by the time I finished jogging, I thought, I'm going to have a serious discussion with him. I'm going to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Starr was pretty bright.
He knew exactly what he was doing, and his importance to the newspaper war cannot be overestimated.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking about the Arkansas Gazette newspaper and its rivalry with its competitor, the Arkansas Democrat. We'll return in a moment. Let's return to our discussion with Donna Lampkin-Stevens as she talks about the Arkansas Gazette's battle with its rival, the Arkansas Democrat.
Mr. Hussman had several different strategies, and they all seemed to work. John Robert Starr was one. He also switched the Democrat to a morning publication cycle, which took them head-to-head against the Gazette. He decided to increase his news hole, make the paper fatter, more stuff in there, to be able to proclaim the Democrat was Arkansas's largest newspaper. He also delivered the Wednesday edition to every household in central Arkansas, called a full market coverage.
I'm Paul Smith, and I came to the Democrat in 1974. I was the ad director from 74 to 80, and then I was the vice president and general manager up until the late 90s. If I was an advertiser, I would have chose the Gazette because they had a lot more circulation, 2.5 times our circulation. So we had to deliver the newspaper to non-subscribers. We started a program where on Wednesday we would deliver 40,000 copies of the Democrat to non-subscribers in Little Rock, North Little Rock. And that gave us enough circulation to really compete with the Gazette. And that one day, which was grocery day back then, we had a lot of grocery advertising back then, that gave us a chance to go out head-to-head and say, you can save a lot of money by using the Democrat. Now our paper goes to as many homes in the market as the Gazette.
Here's publisher Walter Hussman.
When people thought about subscribing to the Democrat or Gazette, they'd say, well, I can get the Democrat in the morning just like I can get the Gazette in the morning. hey, if I get the Democrat, I get just as much news as I get in the Gazette. Hey, if I get the Democrat, I get the Dillard's ads just like I get in the Gazette. I get the Sears ads. I get the Penny's ads. And actually, I get more classified ads in the Democrat.
But the key pieces in the strategy were adopting free want ads, free classifieds, and also charging a dollar an inch for duplicating major retailers' ads like Dillard's or Montgomery Ward or JCPenney's. Now, a dollar an inch for that valuable retail advertising was much under the cost of production. Now, in response, the Pattersons essentially did nothing. They didn't increase the size of the paper. They didn't increase their staff. And that eventually would prove to be disastrous for the Gazette.
So how much of this boiled down to economics?
Most of it. The Hussmans owned several monopoly newspapers in South Arkansas, but they were not able to use their cable profits in the battle with the Pattersons. But they were able to use the profits from those five monopoly newspapers in Camden and Hot Springs and Texarkana and a couple of other places.
So how much of this came down to journalistic integrity?
Not much. Starr directed the Democrats' news coverage, and then he would write attack columns aimed at those his staff covered.
He was very proud of it. He'd write a column every day.
Former Gazette columnist Ernie Dumas.
7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. He never missed a day. He was very proud of that. A column every single day, whether he had anything to say or not.
Here's Walter Hussman.
Well, when he first started writing, you know, he wrote one, and I went over and I said, hey, Bob, I said, it was something about freedom of information. I said, you know, this might be a good idea to write something about the news business occasionally, because a lot of our readers don't understand, and it's not really our Freedom of Information Act, it's the public's Freedom of Information Act, you know, and everything, and that might be a good idea to do every now and then, you know. Well, then he started writing two or three a week, and then he started writing them every day. When he started writing them every day, I said, Bob, I hired you to be the managing editor to run the news operation, not to write a column every day. He said, I do it after work. I said, well, I mean, that's nuts. You need to relax after work. You know, you need to be ready to go the next day. No, I can do it. I can do it.
It became more and more about the Gazette.
Again, Ernie Dumas.
And he took this war on. He just attacked the Gazette. We were all leftists, and we were all out to shading our stories and writing untruths and so forth. But I mean, he'd write a lot of things about me that were just, I was just astonished that he was writing these things about me. He had some names for me. The wet noodle liberal, he called me. He'd write these columns about the Gazette's wet noodle liberal columnist and editorial writer. But we personally, we were friends.
But some of those editorials, and I've looked at them, were intense. I mean, that Starr wrote.
Oh, yeah.
And they were every day, and people ate it up.
People ate it up. He would even write columns making fun of Carrick Patterson's weight.
So it got personal.
It did get very personal.
I'm Max Brantley, and I went to work for the Arkansas Gazette as a reporter. 1973, became a city editor, an assistant managing editor, and its last year a political columnist, and went to work for the Arkansas Times after the Gazette closed. There was nothing too low for John R. Starr to use. But he was also a veteran newsman, and everything he wrote wasn't without basis. I mean, he did what he did, but he played to win.
I think they had an agreement starting out that Bob was going to do what Bob was going to do, and Walter was happy to stay out of it. He was more business-oriented. He wanted Bob to run the Democrat.
But I liked Bob. I didn't like some of his columns, and I didn't like some of the things he said. But I remember when I was in journalism school, the criticism of newspapers, which were basically mostly monopolies at the time in their communities, was that the freedom of the press is the freedom if you own a press. And I thought that was a pretty biting and salient criticism. And I thought, you know, if I'm ever in a position where I'm a publisher, I'm going to let everybody have their say. I'm going to let people run letters to the editor and have their say. I'm going to let our columnists have their say, even if I disagree with them.
How much came down to resting on laurels?
I think a lot of it. Now, certainly, Walter Hussman was a brilliant businessman and seemed to make every right move. But the Patterson strategy was to not respond to John Robert Starr's allegations. If you don't respond, they're only going to have half of the story.
You write.
When faced with a bold new competitor, Patterson's conservative response had been a textbook example of the newspaper industry's slowness to respond to a threat.
By 1984, though, Hussman's strategy was working, and in May, the Democrat cleared $50,000 and proclaimed, "Complete with employee-worn buttons, we're in the black."
And that was a huge, huge point in Arkansas's newspaper war. Once they began to make money, then, I mean, all the momentum is in their favor.
You talked about mistakes, and in 1984, December 12th, the Gazette files a federal antitrust lawsuit asking that Hussman be stopped from selling below the cost of production. Was that a mistake, too?
I think it was. I think certainly the timing was. Although the Democrat was by then making money, the Gazette was still making lots of money, too. In December 1983, the board had given Hugh Patterson a $150,000 bonus. Now, I don't know about you, but that doesn't sound like a newspaper that's about to go broke.
Yet they contended that the competitor had violated the federal Sherman Antitrust Act and Unfair Practices Act by deliberately operating at a loss to damage the Gazette using profits from other companies to establish a monopoly. That was a hard sell.
Certainly. Certainly to a jury of Arkansans who almost probably none of them were making $100,000 a year in 1984.
Tell us about the two attorneys.
Yes, choice of attorney. Hugh Patterson went out and got the best antitrust lawyer in the country. His name was Stephen D. Sussman from Houston, Texas, and he waltzed into town with an expensive suit and gold pocket watch, and he did not connect with the Arkansas jury.
My name is Steve Sussman with the firm of Sussman Godfrey. I am a trial lawyer, and at the time of the Gazette versus the Arkansas Democrat case, and I was hired to bring the case on behalf of the Arkansas Gazette. As a theoretical matter, the use of monopoly profits in one market to gain a monopoly in another is unlawful. But the problem was, it's very difficult to persuade a jury to win a monopolization case where you are accusing the defendant of charging too little. I mean, the public loves having multiple newspapers, not one, and they love cheap things.
Carrick Patterson told me that they're in court the day of opening arguments, and Steve Sussman opens his mouth and he says, "I turned to my father and I said, we have lost this case." Philip Anderson, the local attorney, was Walter Hussman's attorney. He was a much better fit with the Arkansas jury.
My name is Philip Anderson. I have represented the Arkansas Democrat since it was first purchased by Walter Hussman. I continue to do so. The crux of my argument was that the Arkansas Democrat didn't do anything that was wrong. Everything that it did was pro-competitive, and any complaint that the Gazette had was unfounded. They weren't going out of business. They clearly weren't going out of business. They were making more money each year than they had the year before. They had never lost money.
The Gazette, during this lawsuit, was still trying to be fair in its coverage of the case.
There's a great line in my book where Carrick Patterson is swearing under his breath, saying, "Here we are, completely fair and balanced, and it's going to hurt us. But this is the way it happened, and this is how we have to report it." After 12 days of testimony and 5.5 hours of deliberation, the lawsuit ended on March 26, 1986, when the jury found in favor of the Democrat on all four counts.
The courtroom was packed every day. And when we got to closing arguments, there were people standing around the walls. And Judge Overton said to those people, "You can come on down. Come on before the jury box and sit down. Just sit on the floor." And they did. And they were all around me when I was delivering the closing argument. And it was college-like in many ways, just to see the people sitting, men and women sitting cross-legged on the floor in front of the jury box. And when the verdict was announced, the first person to me was Steve Sussman, who shook my hand and congratulated me on a good trial.
I've got only one recollection of that day, and that's Louise Patterson breaking down in front of the doors to the courtroom, telling her husband, Hugh, that he had destroyed her family, had destroyed the legacy, something like that. I don't remember exactly what her words were. But this was the wife of the publisher of the Gazette. She was distraught because, I mean, Hugh had married into the newspaper. This was her family's legacy. And his too, of course, because he became a part of it, but it came to him through her. And the woman was distraught. And that's all I remember about that day, really. I'm sure I was elated because it slapped me in the face so coldly when I saw her reaction outside the courtroom. It grabbed my heart. You suddenly quit thinking in terms of competition and we won, yay. And you go, oh my gosh. You know, lives have been affected.
Bleeding at every pore, with no strategy to change anything, unable to compete economically, the Patterson family looked to sell the Arkansas Gazette.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and this is Arts and Letters. We'll be back in a moment. Let's return to Donna Lampkin-Stevens as she talks about the sale of the Arkansas Gazette to the Gannett Corporation.
There's no one that you can blame when you're out standing in the rain. There ain't nobody who will remember your name. There's no one that you can blame.
So in the aftermath of the verdict, the Gannett Corporation approached the family, and on October 30th, 1986, the Pattersons announced that they had sold the paper to the Arlington-based company, the nation's largest newspaper chain.
There is nothing that you can do. It's all been tried. It's all been true. You might see red. You might see blue. There is nothing that you can do.
You write that whereas the newspaper war had previously been about competition for advertising, now the war was about circulation.
And there's not the profit margin in circulation rates that there is in advertising. So Arkansas's newspaper war became a financial bloodbath for both sides.
Was it all about circulation from the beginning with Gannett?
They said, this is your paper. You are the people who know what is best for the Arkansas Gazette. Al Newharth, who was the number one guy at Gannett at that point, had been an old friend or acquaintance of Hugh Patterson. And Hugh Patterson said that Al Newharth had promised that they would leave the editorial side alone and that they would bring in, you know, their expertise in advertising and circulation. The news product, the editorial product, would be left alone.
Alan Newharth, yeah. He was a cold customer in a lot of ways.
This is Max Brantley.
But he was brash and he was confident and he said, we're going to win this thing. And we were happy to get cheerful words. There's the famous story that he rode a limousine from the Capitol Hotel to the Gazette for the news conference, which is one block away, which gave you a little bit of a feeling for how Newharth operated. And I do remember they threw a big party at, I guess it was the Excelsior Hotel then, to welcome themselves to town and kind of pitched it as a partnership with the Gazette, which of course it was not. But I walked in and introduced myself to Newharth, and I said, I'm the city editor. And he said, why are you here? Why aren't you at work? So I got back to work. I don't think he was joking.
My name is Deborah Mathis. I'm a writer and longtime journalist at the Arkansas Gazette. I was associate editor and columnist. He was like a Vegas pit boss. I mean, that's the kind of the way he always reminded me of that. Flamboyant to the very end. And Gannett knows how to put on a show. Now, I'll tell you that. They know how to put on a show. And I'm sure that they probably thought okay, guys, we're here now. We can turn this around. I mean, they didn't invest in it to lose. I know that. They thought that they were going to be able to turn it around. They just did not know the market they were in.
The Gazette hadn't entered newspaper contests much before that. They started collecting prizes.
Under Gannett, we started entering contests. But Gannett's purchase brought it really a whole change in philosophy. It became more of a market-driven approach, giving readers what they wanted. Much greater emphasis on features, television, movies, and lesser emphasis on, you know, sort of the, you know, I mean, let's face it, sometimes government coverage, city council coverage is dull, but it's very important.
Right, and they had a succession of managers, one after the other.
One after the other. I mean, Gannett only owned the paper for 5 years, and yet we lost count of the number of editors and managing editors and assistant managing editors and publishers who came through the Arkansas Gazette. More and more of these outside managers came in, and they seemed to have their own ideas about how Arkansas's newspaper ought to be. Some of those Gannett managers in other states didn't like the In the News column, which was on the left-hand side of the front page, which is today one of the few things that's left in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette that goes back to the Arkansas Gazette.
The look of the paper was different. And all these graphics, Gannett loves graphics. Oh, my God. Much shorter stories, different kinds of stories, more touchy-feely kind of things. And it just wasn't the Gazette. It was not the Gazette. And we just begged and pleaded with them to please stop. And that's why I came with the line, if it ain't broke, break it. Because there was nothing wrong with the Gazette itself, the paper per se. But they broke it.
They came in and changed the television listings. Instead of a vertical grid, they wanted a horizontal or vice versa. And there was just an uproar from readers. Now, Gannett does get blamed for some of the changes that were bound to happen anyway. Color photos and comics. By the mid to late 1980s, Arkansas Gazette was going to have color comics and color photos regardless. And I think some people unfairly blamed Gannett for tarting up the old gray lady.
As a journalist, you provide lots of theories for the death knell, basically, of why they lost the war. It wasn't just one thing. There were a lot of things. What else?
Certainly the loss of sports writer Orville Henry to the Arkansas Democrat was a huge blow. Orville Henry had been the Gazette's sports editor since the 1940s. He spent 40-some years running up and down those marble staircases at the Arkansas Gazette, and he became synonymous with Frank Broyles, really created the Arkansas Razorbacks as a statewide program in Arkansas.
Hello, my name is Wade Moore, Jr. I was a sports writer for 23 and a half years with the Arkansas Gazette. I was the assistant sports editor probably the last 8 years with the company. I think deep down he knew that he was the historian of Razorback football. And it was his job to tell that story. And believe me, no one was going to tell it better than he could.
Orville Henry is one reason why the Gazette survived 1957. As angry as people got at the editorial page, they still had to keep up with the Razorbacks, and they still had to keep up with sports.
And Orville, who had been no doubt critical to saving the Gazette back during the segregation crisis, came to feel unloved, and with good reason. He had been devalued, and I think there were many ways in which Orville's time had passed. And he did have blind spots, but he was an immense asset to the paper, and he should have been kept happy, and he was not.
But you're losing your grip, and you're losing sleep, and your boots in the mud, and they're sinking deep. And you gotta make a choice, man. You gotta make a call.
You asked me about his style. His style was long. They cut it short. They edited all his stuff and put stuff in there that he knew that wasn't correct. And that really made him mad.
Don't let the black dog get you. Don't let your eyes get wet. And don't hang out if you want to leave town.
Oh, it was one heck of a writer, man. Every writer that came through the Gazette
Holzover a thanks. He literally trained all of us.
If this could happen to Orville Henry, this could be any one of us.
And he went to the Democrat.
He went straight to the Democrat. He got fed up with the Gannett managers, and he brokered a deal with Walter Hussman, and apparently he said to Walter Hussman at this meeting, the first words out of his mouth were, "I will go to work for you Monday if you will give me this." And he wanted a long-term contract and a small raise. And Gannett never understood. Apparently when the Gannett managers, editors were told, Orville Henry's going to go to the Democrat if we don't do something to make him feel more appreciated. And apparently Walker Lundy, then the editor, said, "Well, so what? Do we care if he goes to the Democrat?" That shows you that they didn't understand.
It was devastating as a psychological thing. It was kind of a public sentiment that something is really going the wrong direction there. There are people on newspapers all over the country that have just become fixtures, and he was a fixture.
That had to be a tough decision for him. But, you know, his family, his staff, we never say, "Hey, we'll teach him, you know, we'll show him." We knew if he was going, something was wrong. So I pretty much backed his decision to go.
The Arkansas newspaper war ended abruptly on October 18, 1991, with the Gannett Corporation selling the Gazette to Hussman, who closed the paper and changed the name of his publication to the Arkansas Democrat Gazette the next day. Gannett lost $108 million during its ownership of the Gazette. Hussman's losses, he said, were significantly less, but still in the tens of millions. So you were working there.
I was there.
Tell us just a little about that day.
What was really odd was I didn't hear anything about this. I was living in Fayetteville at the time, in the Fayetteville Bureau. The first word I ever heard was on Labor Day weekend. In this research, the deal was made in July. The deal was over in July, and nobody knew about it.
A lawyer called me one day, and I think it had to have been a Friday.
Democrat attorney Philip Anderson.
Last Friday in June 1991, and said, "Phil, don't say anything about this, but we're ready to throw in the towel. We're ready to give up. We want you and Walter to come see us on Monday." That was July the 1st. "Just bring Walter. Don't say anything about it to anyone. And come on up here and let's do a deal." And so Walter and I flew to Washington, and we met with the Gazette people, who were good businessmen, very courteous throughout. It was a very easy meeting. It became clear to me that we were at the point where we were going to have to start writing contracts. We got down to business, and it didn't take long to reach a deal.
Yeah, we bought their assets. We wouldn't buy the company because we didn't know what their liabilities were.
Again, Democrat publisher Walter Hussman.
We could not even see their balance sheet or their income statement up until the day it closed. The reason we couldn't see it is if up until the day it closed, if some white knight had come in and wanted to buy it, they didn't want us to have all that competitive information.
Walter and I went to the Justice Department, and the Gannett lawyers had prepared a bar graph chart showing losses through the years that they had been operating the paper. They started off, the bar was below the line, it showed a loss every year, but the lines kept getting longer and longer and longer for each year. And one of the economists in this meeting we were in around the conference table for the Justice Department said, "These are cumulative losses, aren't they?" And the lawyer for Gannett said, "No, those are annual losses." And it raised eyebrows.
Maybe I know exactly how you feel. Just let go of everything you thought was real.
Some people started kind of asking around. And then we would find out that there was some meeting going on with somebody flown in from Gannett or something. And secretly had been spotted at the Excelsior Hotel or something like that. I mean, there are all these little coincidences popping up. So we became kind of convinced then that something is stirring. More and more evidence to that effect began appearing. All the while, we are being told, what are you talking about? Every step of the way, they were denying, and making it seem like we were crazy.
By the time word got out in the newsroom in the community in September, there were rallies, tearful attempts to save the Gazette, and all of that, by that point, looking back now, was absolutely futile.
Oh, yeah, we tried to have some rallies to get to, you know, while we were still hoping to find some people who could support us, but, you know, there was no money. Realistically, it just wasn't there for the very reason that Hugh Patterson sold the paper after he lost the antitrust suit. There was just not a scenario by which there were going to be two profitable daily newspapers in Little Rock. That was always too economically obvious.
Gazette employees feared the worst, although it was so surreal, you just couldn't imagine that there would not be an Arkansas Gazette anymore.
The paper had to be put up for sale to see if there were other buyers. There were no other buyers. So we closed. And I was in a conference room, and the lawyers for Gannett were in another conference room, and we gave the bank authority to go ahead and wire the money. And it didn't come through, and we wondered what in the world was wrong. And then the lawyer for Gannett called and said, the money's here. It's all yours.
And I remember the day it closed, they called and they said, okay, we're over at the lawyer's office. They said, oh, the money's cleared. Okay, I said, I want to see the financial statements, you know. So they brought them in there. And I looked at them and I went, holy cow. I looked at their balance sheet. If you look at property, plant, and equipment before depreciation, that's what the company has invested in all the assets they still own. They had $49 million in property, plant, and equipment. We had $19 million in property, plant, and equipment. I said, God, they have more than double the assets. There's the presses, the trucks, the computers, everything, you know. And I looked at the income statement. They were spending $10 million a year more than we were spending. I looked at the previous year. They'd outspent us by $10 million. The year before that, they'd outspent us by $10 million. I sat there and I thought, they got more than double the assets, almost triple the assets we've got. And they're outspending us $10 million a year. How are we gaining market share against these guys? How do we do it? And I was just sitting there, and I was just kind of pondering. I thought, you know, it was the people. It was the people. And I've never said that publicly, but I mean, I think I said it privately, and I think it probably was kind of disheartening or insulting or whatever to the people at the Gazette. I didn't mean the Gazette people were bad. What I meant was the people at the Democrat. If Gannett won, all those people got to keep their jobs. And if they lost, a lot of those management people, they got, well, Craig Moon got promoted. He was a publisher. He got promoted to Nashville. If we lost, we all lost our jobs, you know. And I lost my job, but so did the single copy manager. Everybody lost their job.
I was living in Fayetteville. I packed up my office. I was coming to Little Rock to cover the Arkansas-Texas football game in 1991 on October the 19th. And I packed up my office in Fayetteville, but I didn't unpack my car. I held on to enough hope that maybe I would have some place to go back to after the weekend. But I didn't.
I go to work that Friday, and I get everything prepared for the crew that's going to come in and do the high school reports. They're going to take the games over the phone. I get them copy sheets, standings, and all that for all the reporters so they have enough there. That probably takes about an hour and a half. I did that every Friday. And I was leaving. Most of the time I stay in there about noon. But I was leaving. I had a friend there, Nancy Clark. She worked in another department. And I walked by her desk. I said, something's going down today. As soon as it does, give me a call. And she said, what are you talking about? I said, something's going to happen today. I know it. Give me a call. And so I go home, and I, sure enough, before noon, I mean, I probably a couple of hours
an hour or so later, she called and said they want everyone to come in. And that was it.
Many employees, like I did, took out personal items in the days leading up to October the 18th. I was in the office that day, and the computers just shut down. We all sort of sat around telling stories and sharing memories, and then word came down, and I don't even remember who the last editor or publisher was who came out and said, "This is our last day." And then we're gathered in the newsroom, and somebody from the Arkansas Democrat came in to speak to the whole crowd and who said, "The Arkansas Gazette is now shut down, and those of you who would like to are invited to apply at the Arkansas Democrat."
They were in the newsroom, and they had the desk pulled back.
Former Democrat General Manager Paul Smith.
Kind of around the room, and the people were in the middle, and they had brought in a publisher named Mo Hickey from Reno. He had been with Gannett a long time, and he had retired, and they had brought him in to shut the paper down. So he talked, and he got out of there.
"This is our last day, and I just got the word from Doug McCorkindale just a few minutes ago."
But I had to get back to the microphone back in the corner, and everybody in that whole building, the ad department, production department, which press room was in a separate location, circulation department, advertising department, newsroom, were all in that building. We couldn't get back there without pushing our way through, and we had to get up on and walk on tables and desks. Step from, you know, desk to tables to get back in that corner where that microphone was. And I told him, I said, "We would welcome any of you to apply for a job at the Democrat," and we hired a lot of them.
"We, however, invite all former Gazette employees to apply at the Democrat for jobs."
And there were a couple of people that were kind of belligerent, but most of them were fine.
After a long and nerve-wracking morning, Gazette employees were told the inevitable. The war was over and the Democrat had won.
"You know, it's a sad day for me. I've worked here all my life. It's a great job."
A few people gave speeches and passed around the whiskey bottle and all of that. I remember Max walking out with a sign because, you know, the press was outside to cover it as we were exiting, with a sign that said, "We'll edit for food."
Very sad day, tremendous amount of tears up there, understandably. We're a big family. Just a tremendous family feeling up there. The announcement got delayed, as I'm sure you know, and we had about an hour and a half, a little pep rally, some inspirational speakers, some old jokes, some Aggie jokes, some old Gazette war stories, and we sort of had a good time.
You know, it was kind of that giddy laughter you have when you just, it's so unbelievable, you almost can't do anything but laugh.
Oh, you know, that last day was, I guess, you know, I knew it was going to happen. The day before the last day, I cleared out my desk. So when the last day came, you know, I knew it was upon us, and some people didn't believe it. But then suddenly the computers went off. They realized something was up, and we sat there for several hours before somebody finally announced something. Whiskey was brought in. There was a lot of drinking in the newsroom, and people stood on desk and spoke their mind, you know, but it was a sad day.
"I couldn't have said it better than Jay in high school said it in 1958, almost 33 years ago to the day. Every newspaper must come to judgment and accounting for the course that forms its image and character. If it is to be more than a mechanical recorder of news, if it is to be a moral and intellectual institution rather than an industry or a property, it must fulfill the measure of its obligation. Even though, in the words of St. Paul, it has to endure affliction.
Hot as it flows, sugar. They come and they go. Do ya expect something more than you? You've got it coming to ya."
You know, people are still upset about this. What lessons can we learn?
You know, Mr. High School once said that a newspaper is not a sawmill, and I think that's a great quote. It just sort of illustrates that a newspaper is more than just a money-making venture. And I think that newspapers today must find the proper balance of giving readers what they need to know with what they want to know. You can't just force-feed dull stuff. You have to have a good balance. You have to have some sports. You have to have some features. You have to have some fun. But they also need to be able to make a difference for their readers in the community. Newspapers have to respond to competition aggressively. They also have to be thoughtful about it. They have to listen to their readers and offer what their online and television competition cannot offer, and that's in-depth analysis by veteran journalists who can explain things. Local owners should be committed to quality journalism, and that costs more than puff and flash. And those owners should also be committed to the communities they serve. You know, Gannett got out of town, and the Arkansas Gazette is about two sentences in the Gannett's company history today. They don't like to talk about it. In today's media environment, sober, serious journalism stands out.
The crack of a dam haunts a lazy town near a fault line. Time can heal a broken heart. Time can heal a broken heart. Time can heal a broken heart. Time can heal a broken heart.
Broadcast from the University District, this has been a special program on KUAR 89.1. Thanks for joining us. Arts and Letters and other programming that airs on this station can be found at KUAR.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to songwriters and musicians, Shannon McClung,
time can heal a broken heart.
Stephen Winter, the Mallet Brothers, Ethan Young, and Blues Boy Jack, for music both reminiscent and relevant. Thank you to KATV Channel 7, Michael Hiblin, Pat Patterson, and Donna Lampkin-Stevens for archival footage from the Gazette's last day. Thanks to Mr. Chris Hickey, whose steadfast dedication to this project includes interviews, production work, and sound engineering. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thanks to everyone who participated in this project and who chronicled the history of the old gray lady, recapturing the spirit of a time not really so long ago. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Robert Fisk. It is the journalist's job to be a witness to history. We're not there to worry about ourselves. We're there to try to get as near as we can in an imperfect world, to the truth, and to get the truth out.